Chuck Klosterman has been described as one of America's top cultural critics. He also writes the ethics column for the New York Times Magazine. So maybe it's only fitting that his new book is a series of suitably Klosterman-esque essays about villains. It's called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon talks with Chuck Klosterman.
One of the essays in your book is called Easier Than Typing, and you start this essay by presenting a thought experiment in which you ask the reader to imagine that Batman is real. Can you tell me about that, Chuck?
Well, I think vigilantes pose a particularly complicated scenario for people trying to understand how we kind of feel about public figures who are in the news. And I say that because if you talk to somebody who is, you know, intelligent, somebody who sort of is thoughtful, and you say, is vigilante justice good or bad for society? They will immediately say, of course not. You know, we have these laws, we have a framework for how society works. You can't have people taking justice into their own hands. But then you give them a slightly more specific portrait of an incident that has happened. You say, in a city that's sort of, you know, dominated by crime, a person who had done nothing wrong, was sitting by himself, is confronted by thugs, and he ends up responding with more violence than they brought toward him, and he sort of is acting on behalf of society, that society is fighting back. Well, then their willingness to emotionally side with the vigilante just amplifies. And then it goes one step further, whereas we sort of learn these details about the vigilante, what he or she is like, what their belief system is, the idea that this act may have been more personal than social, it swings back the other way. Then it's like this person isn't acting on, you know, behalf of the world. They're sort of acting as a rogue free agent. It has nothing to do with social justice. It has to do with a desire for bloodlust or whatever. So I was thinking, you know, about Bernard Goetz, because he's the clearest example of this, the subway vigilante in New York in the 80s. So I started thinking to myself, well, what if Batman was real, okay? And when I say Batman, it's like assume that there isn't this pre-existing knowledge of this character from DC Comics. You know, no one knows who Batman is, so no one knows what his motives are.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out how people would react, and particularly how the media would react if a figure like Batman actually came into play.
And then that's where you go from Batman to Bernard Goetz. And as you touched on earlier, Bernard Goetz, even though he's a victim, the more we find out about him, the more he seems like a villain.
The initial reaction to those shootings was entirely in Goetz's favor.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, about 3 to 4 days, he was a nationally adored figure because New York was just a cesspool of violence at the time. And it just seemed as though this is somebody who was sort of saying to the world, it's like, this is an unacceptable cultural status. We cannot accept our culture to be like this. But then when he was arrested and he started talking about himself and just showed no remorse over what he had done. And I guess there was maybe a social hope that he would be like, I hated shooting those guys, but I had no choice. And instead, he was more like, it was easy shooting them. It was easier than typing.
Hmm.
And then we start going back into his own life, and we realize he said sort of like racially insensitive remarks at a community meeting. And then we find all these strange details about his personal life. It turns out, for example, now he lives in an apartment in New York with a bunch of squirrels. He's become like an advocate for like the squirrel population of New York. Well, now he becomes marginalized as a character, and we no longer see him as acting on behalf of anyone besides himself.
So there's this slippery slope, or there can be, between a vigilante and a villain.
Well, yeah, I mean, because we know all this stuff about Batman the character, we know Batman is good. We know his motive is based on the fact that he sees his parents killed and it changes him, it traumatizes him, and he decides that he doesn't want anyone to experience that kind of trauma. But if Batman were real, of course we would not know those things. We would just know that someone is dressing like a winged mammal going around beating people up who have not had due process. I think that a lot of the people, in fact, who probably like Batman the most as a character, the kind of people who are really forwarding the import of the comic book mythology would be the first people to say, this bat guy needs to be arrested. We need to get him off the street. He's worse than the criminals.
Yeah. It's funny when you said that, that you mentioned Batman as a winged mammal. I had this image given Bernard Goetz as being a squirrel advocate of being Squirrel Man now. He could be a Squirrel Man superhero.
I wonder what would have been the impact of that. I've always thought it was interesting that we don't see more examples of people trying to become literal superheroes. There are people who do this, you know, who dress up in suits and walk the street at night, but it would almost seem like that's such a part of our culture that it would become sort of a normative thing for crazy people to do.
Exactly. And I'd like to see that happen with villains, too. That would be nice. Maybe I don't know who it's up to do it first. Maybe the villains have to initiate it. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's a real mistake if you're a villain, I guess, to become a supervillain, because a big part of being a criminal is being unseen and not being caught. So, like, wearing Joker makeup does seem like a bad move if you want to elude prosecution. Yeah.
But with the cult of celebrity we live in, maybe that's your 15 minutes of fame there, but that's a good point you raised. Chuck, can you tell me about your own archenemy, Rick Helling, who you write about near the end of the book?
Well, I had this incident happen around eighth grade. It was a basketball camp in Fargo, North Dakota, and there was a kid at this camp named Rick Helling, who was, at least in our age group, by far the best player. He was physically imposing and more skilled and very talented. But at least from my perception at that time, an awful person. Maybe the worst person I'd ever met. He was extremely egocentric, and he seemed obsessed with sex, which I know is a normal thing for an eighth grader, but I just found it very uncomfortable. And you know, he didn't listen to the coach, and he was always arguing with the referees, and he was just kind of a bullying figure that really stayed in my mind, you know. And then I remember him going to high school. He went to different high schools. He went to a Catholic school in Fargo called Shanley, and I was kind of in a small town. But he was a good athlete, so his name was in the paper. And then, you know, he ended up becoming a Major League Baseball player, which is the only Major League Baseball player I've ever known personally. So I follow this guy's career. I still feel the same way I did in junior high. So, like, I'm reading the newspaper hoping to see that Rick Helling got shelled. Like, I'm just waiting for him to fail. He wins 20 games one year, and I'm just so disappointed. And he pitches in the World Series, and I'm mad the whole time. Well, I write a piece for Esquire basically about this, where I make this passing reference to having this arch enemy, and then he retires, and I'm like, oh, well, I guess end of story. But then I find out years later, reading an issue of Time magazine in the dentist's office, that Rick Helling, this guy who I'd spent my whole life sort of viewing as the antithesis of me, my arch enemy, was pretty much the first player in Major League Baseball to stand up and take a stand against anabolic steroids. Like, no one listened to him, but he was the first guy to be on record going, like, look, this is a problem. It's screwing the game up, and there's going to be consequences if we don't step in. And then, of course, now, in the wake of what has happened, everyone looks back and go, like, oh, Rick Helling was this truth pioneer. So I just had to come to the realization that the one person I am on record for hating is probably one of the most important baseball players of the last 40 years, despite the fact that his success on the field was very marginal. His import was that he refused to allow something that was wrong to continue happening without sort of standing up and saying, we need to change this. So, you know, that's kind of my life. Like, the people I hate end up being the heroes.
Exactly. As you write in the book, then that makes you the villain.
In my own story.
Yeah. Has writing this book and your work as the ethicist for the New York Times Magazine changed the way you think about good and evil?
Has it changed the way I think about good and evil? I'm not exactly sure I really believe in the concept of evil. There's good and bad, but evil is something different. Being the ethicist has definitely changed my life, though. When you take that job, like, I'm not claiming to be the most ethical person in New York or in America. Like, the title of the job is the ethicist. It's just the name of the column. But I know it's not perceived as that way. It is perceived by other people as someone saying, I know what's right and I know what's wrong. So I'm super conscious of all my actions now. I was walking down the street the other day and I was eating something, you know, and I had like a wrapper and I rolled up the wrapper and I tried to throw it in the wastebasket and I missed. I kind of kept walking and then I was like, I better not do this. If someone sees this, I'm going to get fired. So I went back and I put it away. I'm always very nervous now of being seen as an unethical person. But, you know, that's not the same as being good. And that's part of the problem. Like, if I go through my life making sure I only do good things, but my motive for doing so is just to be seen as not bad, I don't think that's the same as being good for society. That seems like acting all the time. And I sometimes wonder if my good deeds are basically just performances.
Do you really think that, though? You sometimes wonder, but do you really think that that might be true?
I don't think I know. I don't think it's possible for me to know. Because a big part of sort of living a reasonable life is self-deception. We are constantly self-deceiving ourselves into believing that what we're doing is just or important or meaningful, that it almost becomes, well, it does, it becomes a second nature. It's almost like there's a shadow self that is constantly convincing us that what we're doing is being done for the proper reason or the proper motive. And I'm very distrustful of the things that I do. I try to be a generous person. I'm suspicious of my generosity, you know. Try to be an honest person. Why? Am I honest in a way that avoids a straightforward lie but is just like a twisted version of the truth? I can't be accused of straightforwardly making something up. I don't know. You write a book like this because probably you're uncomfortable with your own self. And I think that's probably true about myself.
Chuck Klosterman is the author of I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. Is there a villain, real or imagined, that you find especially captivating? We'd love to know who he or she is. You can get in touch with us through Facebook or Twitter. You'll find links to our accounts on our website, ttbook.org.